for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Hundreds of American paratroopers arrive in Ukraine to train forces battling pro-Russian rebels. Iraq's prime minister urges the U.S. to provide more support to combat ISIS, engaged now in heavy fighting in key Iraqi cities. And the White House moves to take Cuba off the list of nations that sponsored terror. Joining me for this week's top international stories on the Friday News Roundup, David Ignatius of The Washington Post, Elise Labbitt of CNN, and Eric Schmidt of The New York Times. I hope you'll join us. 800-433-8850. Send an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. And welcome to you all.
Thank you.
Good to be here.
Good to be here.
And good to see you. Eric Schmidt, tell us about the role of U.S. paratroopers in Ukraine.
Well, this is one of the consequences of the fighting that's been going on in the East, that the U.S., along with its NATO partners, is now trying to bolster the factions in the pro-West factions in Ukraine. And what they are doing is U.S. forces have gone in there for training in the West. And this was a controversial issue that was delayed by some weeks and months because of the provocation that it might, that was feared it might cause with the Russians. But it's got smoothed over. The U.S. kind of quietly resumed the training now, or went ahead with the training. And this is in order to kind of show solidarity to the Ukrainian government that's in Kiev, as well as send a signal to the Russians elsewhere that the U.S. and NATO partners in Eastern Europe, the Baltics, and those kind of places will be on notice there.
So how is President Putin reacting, Elise?
Well, not very well, obviously, saying that, you know, he's denying that Russian military forces are in Ukraine and doing anything and helping out the pro-Russian-backed separatists to begin with. So obviously not taking that very well, and saying that the efforts by the United States to bring Ukraine closer to the West are really what's fueling this conflict.
David?
Well, I think the latest action with the U.S. paratroopers is part of the long-running story dilemma for the U.S. since the Ukraine crisis began with the seizure of Crimea, which is how do you demonstrate the credibility of U.S. and NATO power in a country that's not a NATO member? How do you help them fight off Russian-backed insurgents without becoming militarily involved at a level that you really couldn't sustain? I think from the beginning, President Obama has admitted that there's an asymmetry here. Ukraine matters more to Russia than it does to the U.S., and that's been part of the problem from the beginning. The paratroopers are a sign that it does matter to us some, and that we're willing to put in more U.S. power.
And in the meantime, David, three of Ukraine's prominent critics that government were killed this week. What's going on?
This is a sign of the violence that takes place beneath the surface across Ukraine. I mean, in this case, these were opponents of the government of Poroshenko that were backing. They were supporters of the previous government, and so it's a sign that violence is not just on one side here. But what we're seeing, and this is, I think, worrying in that it's one of Russia's goals, arguably, is the unraveling of the authority and order of the new government of Ukraine. You know, the more violence you see, the more of these unauthorized killings, the more the Russians can say the situation here is out of control, as we've warned.
Which is a pretext for them to go in and further. And so for the United States, as David said, it's a real dilemma, not only because of the asymmetry of interests, but also because the U.S. needs the Ukrainian government to really step up and take responsibility for some of this. I mean, yes, the majority of the violence has come from the Russian-backed separatists with a lot of Russian hardware and all the like. But there are a lot of human rights violations on the other side, which the U.S., government, and the allies have been a little bit slow to criticize.
And what you also have is a debate that's for now tapped down with the whole question of should the U.S. provide lethal weapons to the Ukrainian forces. This was an issue that has been raised several times and is increasingly on Congress. There was a ceasefire reached in Minsk and back in February, but it's been very shaky, as David and Lisa have mentioned now. And so there are still those within the government that are pushing President Obama to do more. But the argument is, what more will that really help? How will that really help without provoking the Russians who are right next door?
And again, in Ramadi, airstrikes by a U.S.-led coalition against ISIS trying to contain attacks on the key city of Ramadi. U.S. forces in there again, Lise.
U.S. forces in there again, but I would say that we were talking before the show. It's not the kind of full effort that the Iraqis are looking for. And you saw Prime Minister Abadi here this week looking for more airstrikes, looking for more military support. He did get 200 million in humanitarian support because you have hundreds of thousands of people that are fleeing Ramadi. Yesterday, you had the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Dempsey, saying, listen, we don't want Ramadi to fall. It's obviously would not be very good, but he called it bricks and mortar. Mm. And it kind of reminded me of what happened last year when you were looking at the offensive by ISIS on Kobani. The U.S. tried to play down the importance of Kobani, saying we don't want it to fall, but it's just another city. And you have this kind of playing it down again. But you also have the U.S. airstrikes trying to. It would be very symbolic if this capital of the Anbar province, the heart of the ISIS insurgency during the war in Iraq, it would be a very symbolic fall for the Iraqi government. But also you have hundreds of thousands of people that are really suffering, Diane.
David.
Well, I think the battle for Ramadi is the current focus of what is a broad campaign taking place across Iraq, and not yet really in Syria, but that's coming. I think it's important first that the United States was successful in convincing the Iraqis that rather than marching north after the victory in Tikrit toward Mosul, a big Sunni city that was overrun by ISIS last summer in the kind of flashpoint of this campaign that triggered U.S. involvement, that instead it was wiser to move west into Anbar and to try to slowly regain control of Anbar. This is really going to be a difficult battle. The forces that are now called the Islamic State have systematically, starting in 2009, assassinated the tribal leaders and other Sunni elders of Anbar province so that they could gain control, wiping out anybody who would oppose them. I have a contact that I've quoted in my column who counted from 2009 to 2013, before any of us had heard of this conflict, 1,500 of these Sunni leaders were assassinated in Anbar province by these Islamic State forces. So, you know, when you look at this campaign, you see the shakiness of Ramadi. The reason is that there's been a long, ongoing effort to take down opponents. I doubt that Ramadi will fall, frankly. The U.S. has a quite substantial presence in Al-Asad Air Base, which is just to the west. Really is dug in there, has lots of firepower, Apache helicopter gunships, which are fearsome weapons of war. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot more in the area, and these reports of, half a kilometer from the center of the city, I'd be surprised if Ramadi fell.
What about Iraq's Prime Minister al-Abadi publicly criticizing the Saudi air campaign in Yemen? And then a little later on, he softened his tone.
He did. He did. The prime minister was here, as David had said, trying to seek both military assistance and economic assistance in doing this. But clearly, he was critical of the Saudi campaign there. Basically, many people thought defending the Iranian line. Now, here's the interesting thing, Diane, is that even as he's appealing for American assistance, he's clearly also dependent on Iranian assistance on the ground. We've seen that with the Shia-backed militia there. And this is one of the tussles. The Americans are caught in the middle, obviously wanting to support the Abadi government, whether it be the military assistance or others, but not getting too cozy with the Iranians and putting pressure on the Abadi government, in fact, in places like Tikrit, saying we cannot move forward with our airstrikes and our assistance if you put too much reliance on these Iranian-backed Shia militias on the ground.
So the president gave the prime minister a full endorsement, $200 million in humanitarian aid, but he says he's still in need of billions of dollars.
Well, and that's why you had the World Bank meetings this week. He was also meeting with the head of the World Bank and the head of the IMF, Christine Lagarde. I mean, they are looking for billions and billions of dollars, trying to restructure their debt, stop some of their repayments. I mean, listen, I think they're across the board, everyone feels that Prime Minister Abadi has done much better than Prime Minister al-Maliki, his predecessor, did in terms of trying to bring the country together, trying to deal with some of the sectarianism in the country. He's made deals with Sunnis, he's made deals with Kurds, but he still is subject to the same restrictions and problems and debt that the previous government had.
Elise Labbitt, Global Affairs Correspondent for CNN. Short break here. When we come back, we'll talk about those former Blackwater security guards sentenced in the shooting of unarmed civilians. Stay with us.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from America's Natural Gas. Learn how Tote Maritime is working to reduce emissions across their fleet by building container ships that run on natural gas. Learn more at thinkaboutit.org. From Carbonite, providing secure backup and recovery for businesses and homes. Since 2005, Carbonite has backed up more than 500 billion files from email servers to family photos. Learn more at carbonite.com. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
Welcome back. We are in the hour devoted to international topics on the Friday News Roundup. We do invite you to join us, 800-433-8850. David, Iran's president dismissed the compromise worked out between Obama and Congress over the nuclear agreement. He softened his tone somewhat now because it looks as though the agreement they got, the White House is on board, Congress is on board. What happened?
Well, President Obama has been trying very hard to prevent Congress from having an up or down vote on the nuclear deal that he is seeking to negotiate with Iran over the next 60 days, roughly. And I think you'd have to say this week he failed. He had lobbied very hard. He had argued that this was encroaching on executive authority to conduct foreign policy. It's not Congress's role to vote these things up or down. But because of a compromise between the leading Democrat on the Senate Foreign Affairs Committee, now Ben Cardin, after Menendez has stepped back and the Republican chairman, Senator Corker, there was a so-called compromise version of this, which modestly reduces the bite of congressional action. And it passed 19-0, an unusual bipartisan vote. Before the vote, Secretary of State Kerry was up on the Hill saying the president's going to veto this unless you pull back and talking tough. The White House made a decision midday that they just didn't have the votes. And so they have now decided to, you know, embrace this. They believe that this will give Congress a way to play a role, but not a role that can derail the agreement. I think that's the heart of what the White House is saying internally, and I'm sure also saying to the Iranians. And Rouhani seems to have taken that message, that he said, I'm negotiating a deal with the P5 plus one, this broad international group, not negotiating with Congress. In a sense, he's sort of saying, I'm going to look past this congressional action to the negotiations around the table.
Eric, here's an email from Barry. He says, could the other members of the P5 plus one simply ignore the U.S. Congress if they do not lift sanctions on Iran and simply lift their sanctions if a deal is reached, with many of the P5 in economic distress? I don't see why they'd pay our dysfunctional Congress any attention.
Yeah, I'm sure that's probably how they're thinking in these capitals right now. What's the use of Congress? But this is a deal that was struck among all these different countries, and I think what you'll end up is, coming back to what David said, is that the White House has been backed into a corner. They realized they were going to lose the votes. But in the end, they believe they'll have, if it comes to it, a vote of disapproval, the president will still have at least 34 Democrats who will side with him, and he'll be able to sustain a veto in the end and push this one through. This is going to be a negotiation that will go right down to the end and maybe probably pass that end of June deadline, at least by a few days.
I think what's more concerning is the fact that, and I was in Luzon for these negotiations, is that you have now, with comments by President Rouhani and the Supreme Leader about sanctions being lifted on day one, after the White House came out and said sanctions would be lifted in phases, and so did all the other P5+1 countries also, you have differences emerging between Iranian and U.S. interpretations of the deal. And when we were there and the White House announced its fact sheet with all this wonderful concessions that Iran was going to make in exchange for phased out sanctions with a snapback if Iran violates the deal, Iran did not sign its name to that deal. They did not want an official document. And in fact, after the White House said, put out its fact sheet, the Foreign Minister Zarif of Iran was tweeting it out that this is spin, and that's not really what happened in the room. So we asked, I asked Secretary Kerry, I interviewed him, and I said, well, what's to happen if what are you going to do if the Iranians try to relitigate this? Their name's not on that fact sheet. They're calling it spin. What if they try to reopen the negotiations? And lo and behold, look at what they're trying to do. They're trying to, say, oh, that's not really what we agreed to. And by the way, our name's not on that paper. So I think this portends a very difficult session in terms of nailing down the final agreement, because both sides are not on the same page about what was agreed to in Luzon.
I think Elise is absolutely right, and I should say she's one of my journalistic heroes for suffering through the days and days of negotiations and reporting on them clearly. The truth is that at the end of that long negotiation in Switzerland, the U.S. did not have a final deal. And you can tell that by the two documents that emerged. Mm-hmm. There was the U.S. fact sheet, which asserts that the deal contains provisions that we all called better than expected, pretty good. The general consensus was it was a pretty good deal. And then there was another statement that was expressed by both Javad Zarif, the Iranian foreign minister who had negotiated for them, and by the European Union representative, which was much more limited. And then there was an Iranian version of the terms, which was way more limited. So what this tells us is that the end game is still to be played. And I think the White House understands it's going to have to compromise towards some positions that, you know, it's going to have to give a little bit of ground on some of the areas that were asserted in the fact sheet, and they're going to try to choose the ones they think will have the least real impact on the deal's ability to verify Iranian compliance, the things that really matter. I was hearing this week that there may be some surprises in the other direction, that there may be some things in the area of verification that are actually tougher than what we now think. Huh. So, you know, I'm sure people have got lots of cards up their
yeah.
sleeve. The Iranians are very good at bargaining, at kind of saying one thing and doing another. It turns out the U.S. is pretty good at that, too.
So?
Well, especially since the two people who really became key players, and Elise probably knows more about this, are the energy secretaries, Energy right. Secretary Moniz and this deal. Because as David said, well, you may have differences in political sphere and the actual how you present this. Moniz and his Iranian counterpart will be able to come forth and say, well, you can say that politically or you can put that on the document, but we can figure out technical ways around that if you allow us. And that's what's going to be interesting to see how
and
that
boils why, down to. That's exactly why the administration has been very careful to put Moniz, a nuclear physicist and top scientist of the United States, out as the front man on this deal, briefing Congress with Secretary Kerry and saying that, you know, the science behind it, trust the science. What a diplomat say is, listen, you know, some of what's going on right now is spin on both sides. You know, the Moniz and the Iranians are calling it dueling narratives. Part of it is spin. Part of it is the fact, as David said, that, you know, a lot of things have not yet been agreed
right.
to. But what diplomats
right.
say is the real hurdle has been overcome, that the big political decisions have been made. Iran has agreed to certain curbs. We've agreed to lift those sanctions. And so they say that they've made those big political decisions, and now they feel that, you know, the devil is not in the details. The devil was before. But I think that these negotiations, as I totally agree with Eric, they're not going to end on June 30th. You saw how long it took to get just a framework deal. It took two extra sessions. So I think a year from now, maybe we'll be talking about the final deal.
All right. Let's go back to Blackwater. Four former Blackwater security guards sentenced in the shooting of 31 unarmed civilians. Who were they, Eric?
These were civilians that were gathered in a major square in Baghdad in 2007. And this shooting became emblematic, Diane, of the reliance the United States had at that point on private security contractors and really the unaccountability of these private armies, if you will, that were called in to provide security for American diplomats, for companies there on the ground. And this is really an extraordinary trial. So the first trial didn't go well, but the FBI and other prosecutors were involved in building this case, including testimony from Iraqi civilians who were there on the ground in terms of what the impact was. And so this is quite dramatic. Of course, what was also interesting was the defendants, all four of them, stood up in public and denied this, said they were coming under fire, and they have a lot of support behind them. So I think this will be an interesting case to watch, you know, as it runs out.
They said they were under fire. Was there supporting evidence to indicate that?
Obviously not sufficient to convince the judge and jury. The judge sentenced them to long prison terms. Eric summed it up well. That was a period in which U.S. military power and then the private security force power ruled the streets in Baghdad. Baghdad was like the Wild West then. And there is something, I think, notable and laudable about U.S. justice, you know, slowly bringing people to account. The Iraqis don't seem overwhelmingly impressed by it, but I just think in terms of getting ourselves back on track after that period, the idea of holding people accountable, you know, judging the evidence as best you could, what happened on that day in 2007 in Nisour Square in the middle of Baghdad, and saying you cannot behave in a lawless way. That's a good thing. It's part of the road back from that very difficult period.
One of those guards sentenced to life in prison without parole. Three others to 30-year terms for killing 14 civilians. Let's turn to Cuba with another major step, U.S. relations this week. David, the White House announced Tuesday President Obama intends to remove Cuba from the American government's list of nations that sponsor terrorism. Huge step.
It is a big step. This has been a period in which President Obama has really been able to move the agenda he began office with, which was in terms of foreign affairs, trying to engage adversaries of the United States, talk to them, Iran, the most obvious example, but Cuba on that list. Dealing with Cuba was a politically risky issue. The political power that Cuba lobbied, the power that the lobby that keeps existing sanctions kept them in place, was something to take on. The president did it. The president met last week in Panama with Raul Castro, the Cuban leader, then followed the formal removal of Cuba from this list of nations that sponsor terrorism. And, you know, we're now in a period in which the reengagement of the U.S. and Cuba, the reestablishment soon, I think, of diplomatic relations, significant U.S. investment in Cuba, return to the kind of relationship that existed before Castro, before the Cuban Missile Crisis, before all these events, back when most of us were children, not even born yet. I mean, that long period, Cuba was a sort of ground zero of the Cold War, seems to be ending.
Well, I think they have a long way to go. I mean, clearly this was one of the major hurdles. The Cubans said that they would not, you know, reopen an embassy or normalize relations or restore diplomatic ties until Cuba was taken off the list. And, I mean, most people recognize that although Cuba did support a lot of revolutionary movements that were violent in Latin America in the 70s, even Secretary Kerry in his statement said times have really changed since 82 when they were put on the list.
You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. But Cuba's been on that list for, as David says, decades, a designation shared by Iran, Sudan, and Syria. Why now? Why do you think that President wanted this so much?
Well, I think you're right. This designation has been in place since 1982. It was imposed on the Cubans because of their support for leftist insurgencies, also for harboring terrorists, such as Baas terrorists, even some accused cop killers from the United States went down there. But I think the administration looks as this is part and parcel of this broader reopening with Cuba, that to have, it was inconsistent with that policy, if you're going to say we're going to have full diplomatic relations, to have this staying out there, this counter-terror, this terrorism designation on that. So I think that was part of this, and they had to go through the law 6 months without basically saying that Cuba has done anything to warrant being on that list, and so they could lift it now. Now, one couple points I wanted to make, Diane, was kind of watching as we step back broadly some of the themes we've been talking about, and David just touched on this. We're talking about major legacy issues now for the president. We're in the last 2 years of his administration, an Iran nuclear deal, reopening of Cuba, big trade deals now that look like they're going through Congress. This is also setting up a confrontation, though, with the Hill, and the Hill is, for the first time, really, in his administration, becoming much more assertive on foreign policy. You saw the Speaker of the House, John Boehner, was in the Middle East, you know, touring there and trying to get some street cred, I guess, from doing that. So watch that development. Obviously, we've been talking about Congress's role in the Iranian deal, but they'll be involved in Cuba in terms of reopening that embassy and the money that goes forward, and obviously on the trade deals.
So you've got lots of Republicans already speaking out against President Obama's plan to reestablish embassies, to reestablish full trade and the like.
Sure, Republicans and some Democrats. And we mentioned Senator Menendez even before he steps down. There are plenty of others who don't believe this is the right course. And so they'll still have a fight on their hands on the Hill as he goes forward. And that's just on the foreign, international side.
I think, though, that a lot of them, this is just an opportunity to criticize the president, because before he did it, there was a lot of support, even among Republicans, for restoring diplomatic relations, ending the embargo. A lot of agricultural states are really chomping at the bit to do business there. I don't think it's going to be as difficult to lift the embargo. I think, though, there will be a long, drawn-out process. But I think that, you know, Secretary Kerry will be going, you know, in the not-too-distant future, I would say in the next month or so. The U.S. embassy will be open to great fanfare. The Cubans will open up an embassy here. Americans will flock to Cuba because of all the curiosity that we've had for all these decades of going. But there is a lot of mistrust still between the Cuban government, I would say more from the Cuban government side than the United States. And I think it's going to be a long way back for while the two countries, people-to-people exchanges, are going to certainly increase. I think the diplomatic road back is going to be long and hard.
Long and hard, David.
Well, I think sometimes when these things get started, there is a momentum and they end up moving more quickly than you think. I wouldn't want to make a prediction. I think the people who have tough times ahead are the people around the Raul Castro and his brother. I mean, that archaic system of government that suppressed freedom in Cuba for so long is going to go, and they've got to know they're not long for power.
David Ignatius of the Washington Post, Elise Labbitt of CNN, Eric Schmidt of the New York Times, all here to speak with you when you call after a short break.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Constant Contact, committed to helping small businesses and nonprofits meet their goals and succeed with email marketing. Personalized marketing help is available via phone, seminars, and webinars. More at ConstantContact.com. And from Rhodes Scholar, with educational travel adventures to 150 countries, including Cuba, offering experiences for grandparents and grandchildren, active outdoor enthusiasts, and others. A catalog is available at roadscholar.org.
Cut to everyone on campus getting as drunk as they want montage.
On the next Fresh Air, Joel McHale. He stars in the comedy series Community. NBC canceled the series, but its sixth season is now on Yahoo. McHale also hosts The Soup on E! Where he satirizes reality TV. Join us.
It's time to open the phones, taking your calls, comments. First to St. Petersburg, Florida. Hi, Tony, you're on the air. Tony, are you there? Okay, let's go instead to Ingrid, who's here in Washington, D.C. Hi there.
Hi, Diane. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Certainly.
Your guest, Ignatius, misreported on the Iran negotiation bill in Congress. It's not a done deal. That was a committee vote. However, the real vote is imminent, and now is the time for people who support diplomacy to contact their senators and tell them to oppose the Corker-Menendez bill. And also, if their representatives in the House would support a Dear Colleague letter that's being circulated by Jen Schakowsky, Lloyd Doggett, and David Price to support diplomacy.
Well, the caller is correct that this was a committee vote, but it is expected to have a very wide support in the full Senate when it goes to the floor because of this compromise was able to bring over a lot of Democrats. I think that the fact that the president is signing, said he would not veto this and would sign it into law, signifies that the White House feels that this does give them a chance for diplomacy, gives them a chance to conclude a deal. And diplomats have also, involved in the talks, have also said, look, we're kind of lukewarm to this. We don't love it, but it gives us the necessary time to do the job, to get that diplomacy and that deal done. But it is true that after July 10th or so, if there's no agreement, It's anything goes, so we'll have to see what happens.
To Carl in Jacksonville, North Carolina, you're on the air.
Hi, Diane. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was listening to your conversation in regards to Cuba, and, you know, I'm from North Carolina, and Jesse Helms was a staunch opponent of any normalization of any type of diplomatic ties with Cuba. But isn't the Republican Party following the same lines as the Hyde Amendment is with going on with holding up our Attorney General for the United States, where these are just things that they cover for themselves? I mean, does this not seem like what it should be, which is, you know, the legacy type problem?
David.
Well, the Republicans aren't invested in giving President Obama a good legacy. These are, as the caller says, issues that are important to the Republican base. There are some powerful interests that oppose normalization of relations with Cuba and oppose lifting the trade embargo. And so some Republican members are obviously going to play to that, as they do on other key issues to the base, the Hyde Amendment, the whole issue of, I assume you're referring to birth control, right to life issues. You know, those are historically and still very important to Republican members. One of the questions about the next year and a half is whether we're going to see any continuation of this little glimpse of bipartisanship that surfaced in the compromise that was made over the Corker-Cardin approach to the Iran negotiations. I'm giving it both a Republican and Democratic name. For example, will we see Republicans and Democrats get together in sufficient numbers to get these free trade bills passed? That will be opposed strongly in this case by the Democratic base. Trade unions hate these bills. Yep. President will be going against his own party. But are we going to see a continuation of that? It's hard to say.
All right. And this year marks the 100th anniversary of what has been called the Armenian Genocide. The EU is urging Turkey to recognize it for what they say it was. They have a new resolution. What does it entail, Eric?
It involves that. The European Parliament would have Turkey acknowledge that this occurred beginning in 1915, the massacre of up to 1.5 million Armenian Christians over several years. The Turks are opposed to the word genocide, which has a very specific meaning, which if they were to acknowledge that would basically put them in the camp of Hitler or Pol Pot or other mass killers like that. They have acknowledged, the Turkish government has, that there were atrocities on both sides and killings on both sides, but they are very unwilling and strongly object to that use of that word. Whenever it comes up, and even when the Pope brought it up last week, they pushed back, withdrew their envoy to the Vatican. And so this is something that's very, very, very important in Turkish politics.
You know, it's so interesting. The question of reparations came up, and I had so many emails from people saying, I don't want reparations. I just want an apology for the suffering that I and my family have endured. What do you think is going to happen here, David? Anything different?
Well, probably not in the short run. I think it is true that most Armenians, both in the country of Armenia and in the diaspora, are not thinking about reparations. They would like to see this historic wound closed. They'd like an apology. They'd like an admission. They'd like the word that has come to be used for things like this, the killing of 1.5 million people pretty systematically, which is genocide, to be used by the Turks to, for this 100 years of refusal to say it, to end. I should just say, because it's well known to my readers, my own family on my father's side is Armenian, and I, you know, so this is an issue that I think about, you know, as a journalist, but also in a very personal way. Just to speak from my own views, which I'm going to write next week in a column, I do think at the end of the day this is an issue now for Turkey. For Turkey to be a fully modern country, to walk into the future, to have the future that Turks dream of and deserve, they need to reckon with their past. It's like any country, any people, anywhere. And I think that so in that sense, it's an issue that the Turks should think about. The leadership that will change this is going to come from Turkey, not from Pope Francis, not from the European Parliament, but from Turkey.
Turkey is an important ally of the U.S. Has the U.S. brought any pressure to bear on Turkey on this issue?
The pressure has tended to move the other way. The Turks are so upset about this. They see it as an insult to Turkishness, to their nation, and so they've worked very hard to keep U.S. presidents from using the word genocide every April on the 24th. This anniversary of what happened in 1915 is commemorated, and every year there's a big Turkish effort to keep politicians from passing legislation or using the G word, people even call it. And so I'm sure that's continuing. It'll be interesting to see what President Obama does next week.
There have been a lot of efforts on the Hill, too. There is a strong Armenian lobby, and they've tried to get the U.S. Congress to speak up. And I can't remember exactly, because we're going back years, but I remember there have been instances over the years, if you have a congressman or congresswoman who has referred to it as genocide on their own, the Turkish government gets very upset, will recall their ambassador. It's caused a lot of deepening of tensions between the U.S. and Turkey at inopportune times over the years when there was tensions in the region. And I think that now that, you know, I totally agree with David that it is not going to come. And Prime Minister Erdogan said that this is not going to, we're not going to say this is a genocide on someone's orders. This is something that Turkish leadership, and it's probably not this leadership. You know, Erdogan has become very nationalist in over the years, certainly, as Turkey has faced a lot of problems in the international community. I don't think that the Turks on this commemoration of the centennial are ready for that.
And Turkey has withdrawn its own ambassador from the Vatican.
Yes, I mean, this is in protest. And just as the Pope Francis made these remarks just last week, I mean, it's just as my colleagues have said, this is just a lightning issue for them. And this is how they'll react.
And now we have thousands dying, trying to flee North Africa for Italy this week. What is happening there, Elise?
Well, this does happen, you know, every year, and particularly the unrest in Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, the Arab Spring. Over the years, migrants from North Africa feel that they'll have a better opportunity in Europe. They go to Italy, they try to go to Spain, and they, now that it's spring, you know, migrants get on the boats, they make a very dangerous, perilous journey. And it's,
but what's different this year than last?
Well, now the European Union is debating on what to do, and they, you know, they don't want people to die, but what they're trying to do is sometimes they rescue them, and that encourages more people to come. And so now they're talking about efforts to stop this at its source, to train Egyptians or Tunisians or Moroccans to interdict these migrants before they come, but also at the same time set up, you know, refugee camps or reception centers for migrants so they can, you know, try and stop them from coming. But if the ones that legitimately are seeking asylum, that they can, you know, have a place to do it, but not on European shores, because once they get there, it's usually too late.
They stay.
This week, the numbers were so high. It was one of those weeks that just made you realize the dimensions of this problem. 10,000 people are supposed to have tried the migration. A ship with 400 aboard is supposed to have sunk. They were horrifying images of desperate people. But what concerns me is that as I look at the economic and other data about the crisis that's sweeping North Africa and the Middle East, I don't see it letting up. I mean, we have wars across the region. We have slowing economic growth. We have these enormous refugee flows that are straining social services everywhere. And we have a sharp decline in oil prices, which means that even Saudi Arabia is expected to suffer a current account deficit this year and is going to go into the red in its budget this year and next year. In other words, there just isn't any money to bail out a region of the world that is in a terrible situation. So as grim as this week's refugee flight was, I fear we're in for continuation, even a worsening of that in the coming, not just months, coming years.
And if you look at some of the countries that are routed, where these migrants come through, you see either a lack of government such as Libya, and those becoming such an important entree into the space, or even in Tunisia and Egypt that are struggling with their own internal security problems. They don't have the resources necessarily to put ships at sea or people on the borders. And so that word gets out, and the migrants come, and they're flowing into these new routes really with no barriers to exit. And so that's another one of these problems, the economic drivers and the humanitarian drivers that are pushing them out and no real means of keeping them back.
And then they come here, and they're disenfranchised, and they don't have money, and they don't have opportunity. And obviously not all of them are extremist or in any way dangerous, but it's in some of these areas where they are living, where there's poverty, where there's, you know, violence.
It's going to breed.
It's going to breed instability and chaos. And this is where you see a lot of the Europeans, not all of them, some of them come from wealthy, you know, good families and good educational backgrounds. But a lot of these people that are traveling to Iraq and Syria are coming from these disenfranchised neighborhoods.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Eric Schmidt, Google is in hot water in Europe. What's it accused of?
Well, they've been accused by the European Union's antitrust, major antitrust violations of basically steering competitor, you know, the Google searches that you would do, searches, data searches, away from rivals to their own comparison websites. And so this is something that the European Union is looking very hard at. It's the biggest case since the Microsoft antitrust case of a few years ago. And Google could stand to face billions in euros in penalties should this go forward.
It's really interesting that Google managed to avoid this here in the United States. So how come it's now happening in Europe, David?
Well, you're right. There was a Microsoft trial. There was an antitrust suit brought by the Justice Department that, in effect, prevented Microsoft from being as aggressive in the online space as it might have been. And, you know, you could argue helped encourage the rise of Google as such a dominant player in search. There has not been a similar challenge, you know, even as Google's share of the search market and search now, you know, is the driver for so much of the Internet. That has not been challenged in court here. It is being challenged in Europe. And in Europe generally, I think there is a suspicion about the dominance of American technology companies and a desire to push back. It's linked in part to post-Edward Snowden fears about when American technology dominates, it provides an entree for American security agencies like the NSA. But more generally, I think Europe fears that it's just going to get overwhelmed culturally, technologically by a United States that's so robust.
I think the culture is different, and that's why Europe has stricter privacy laws than the United States, for instance. In Europe, you can take something off the Internet if it's, you know, if you think it's wrong and, you know, not written very nicely about you. And that's why they are, you know, very strict about what they, you know, these searches. And I read that this is important because 90% of Internet searches in Europe are conducted on Google. And given that dominance, the Europeans feel that not only do they have a, you know, commercial bias, but also a privacy one.
So they could really face as much as $6 billion in fines?
Well, and it's possible that they settle. I mean, Facebook has been in conversations with a lot of these countries for a while and has agreed to open itself up to, you know, investigators to see about some of their privacy laws. So it's possible that there could be some kind of settlement in which they pay some money, but they open themselves up to more regulation.
All right. And before we end, I just want to offer a word of congratulations to our colleague John Dickerson, who has been a regular on the Friday News Roundup. He will replace our beloved Bob Schieffer as host of Face the Nation. John Dickerson is a terrific reporter, and I'm so pleased for him. We are going to have Bob Schieffer on the program before he leaves that chair, but we certainly wish John Dickerson all the success in the world.
That's right.
I know you know him well, David.
He's a wonderful journalist. Great to see a journalist of that quality get an opportunity like that.
Absolutely.
Like
David Ignatius of The Washington Post, Elise Labatt of CNN, Eric Schmidt of The New York Times. Have a great weekend,
you too.
Everybody.
Thank you.
Thanks, Diane. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkert, Denise Couture, Susan Casey, Rebecca Kaufman, Lisa Dunn, Danielle Knight, Allison Brody, and Alexandra Boti. The engineer is Timothy Olmsted. Natalie Yurev-Lifker answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. And we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington, D.C. This is NPR.